You're listening to CITR News, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Akhil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 24th of April, at 12.04 a.m. We're recording this episode from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkmiyum-speaking Musqueam people.
City elections are around the corner, and municipal parties are finalizing their nominations. Today, we are speaking to Dr. Devyani Singh, who was recently nominated as the city council candidate by the Greens.
Dr. Devyani Singh is a climate scientist specializing in energy and climate policy. She also holds an MBA in finance and worked for several years in industry as a financial analyst. She previously ran in the 2020 provincial election and the 2021 federal election for Vancouver Point Grey and Vancouver Quadra.
Thanks so much for taking the time to meet with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, so to start us off, could you tell us a bit more about yourself and what motivated you to run for office for now the third time?
Yeah, well, I'm Devyani Singh, like you said, and I'm a climate scientist. You know, I'm also an economist, and my current position is a postdoctoral economist fellow, where I'm working with the Environmental Defense Fund, you know, looking at how to make natural climate solutions become a part of climate goals and, you know, and the role they'll play in a 1.5 or a 2-degree pathway. Originally, I am from India, grew up in a military household, so really didn't belong to any place, but, you know, my mountain home where in the Himalayas, where we spent our summers. I guess growing up in India in the Himalayan mountains, I think that's really when my love for nature and environment began. And it was even in the 80s, we could see the impacts of climate change, or we called it global warming then. I used to see these beautiful neon birds come to my chestnut trees. I hadn't seen them in a few years. These species were going extinct, and the mountains that I love so much were really bearing the brunt of it. But it's not as simple as, oh, that's when I decided I wanted to be a climate scientist. In India, in the 80s and 90s, especially as a woman, there weren't a lot of these opportunities open. And so I decided, you know, my choices were the usual, the doctor, engineer, or become a business person, you know, the way it was. And so I definitely didn't want to be a doctor or an engineer. I'm a different kind of doctor now, but not a medical doctor. So yeah, I decided to do business, and I figured I'd earn tons of money as a child. That's my idea. And then I would open up an ENGO and animal shelter homes. That was my workaround. So, you know, did the usual, a BCom honors in college, and then came to the U.S. to do an MBA in finance, started working in corporate America, and a couple of years in, realized I'd been selling my soul, and I was working against the only thing I ever cared about, which is environment. And so I took a leap of faith. I quit, went back to school to do a second master's in environmental science, and that's when I reconnected with this passion. And so that brought me to UBC for my PhD in forestry. Back in 2012, and I've been here since. Luckily I did finish my PhD a few years ago. You know how long that takes. Yeah, that's how I came here, and I was in the Faculty of Forestry at UBC. I looked more at energy access and energy transitions and overall climate policy, and, you know, doing science for policy, basically finding answers to policy questions, and then, you know, doing the work and then writing policy briefs and trying to reach out to elected politicians, and them not caring about the science or not taking action really started to frustrate me. And that's kind of what got me involved in 2020 in politics, was I was really frustrated with the total lack of political will in tackling the climate emergency at the scale that's needed. And science has the answers. We know how to, we as scientists know how to find those answers. And so when the opportunity came in 2020, I decided to run. And I figured if politicians won't listen to science, then I'll just take the science to them. That's really what got me involved. And that's kind of... When I ran, that was what got me involved. And then I realized it became a lot more than just climate change for me. It became about representation as a woman of color, an immigrant, a grad student at UBC. We know how hard it is as students at UBC to be able to live in this city and to afford to, even pay our rent. I was paying 100% of my student stipend in rent for many years. You know, that's not affordable. What are the issues we face as migrants? What are the issues we face as people of color, as renters? You know, and I realized these were the voices of not being heard in government at any level either. Then, you know, for all these reasons that I continued to run federally, I've realized in the last few months that there's actually a lot of change that can happen at the local level. You know, you really have the power to do something, you know, like federally and, provincially, you can do stuff. But really at the local level, I can pass motions. I'm a one voice in 10 versus as an MLA or an MP, I'm one voice in hundreds or, you know, like under 100 for an MLA. But it's still not as much. So I really, you know, I'm excited about running for city council because there's a lot of work to be done in Vancouver. I love this city. It's been my Canada home for the last 10 years. And I think it really should be affordable and livable for all of us. People who work here, people who grew up here, people who study here, everyone should be able to live here and be able to afford it. So that's kind of how I got involved on the political side of it. Sorry for the long answer, but I hope that was useful.
No, it was great. And you covered a lot of topics that we're going to touch on later in the interview, a bit of foreshadowing there. So you've been a strong proponent of Natural Climate Solutions, or NCS. You mentioned you're now working with, I think, the Environmental Defense Fund. On April 22nd, just a couple of days ago, you penned a piece where you stated, quote, well-designed NCS crediting and trading systems can help close this gap at a lower cost and at a faster pace because emissions reductions and removals achieved through NCS are often less expensive per unit of CO2 equivalent than those achieved by other means, unquote. Could you expand on how NCS crediting systems would work in kind of layman's terms and why they're the right tool in your mind to tackle climate change?
Yeah, so natural climate solutions involve, you know, a lot. So it's like you could say, I'm talking about crediting them, so which would be fall under the carbon credits, where you would be trading in carbon sequestration and mitigation from natural climate solutions. Natural climate solutions can include pulling out of carbon from the atmosphere, you know, which is by through, like, let's say, planting trees and afforestation, or it could be to mitigate the emissions that's happening from improved agriculture, improved farming practices, or from reduced deforestation. So that's what we mean by natural climate solutions. And the reason I want to explain that before getting into it is not everybody understands what we mean by this. So they have a very important role to play. I don't like to call carbon credits as offsets because governments wrongly and companies are using them to, you know, increase production and offset the emissions they are creating rather than using them the way I feel and a lot of scientists feel should be used, which is we need to reduce our emissions always possible, such as a just transition away from fossil fuel infrastructure. But we'll never be able to have zero emissions as a society because there'll always be emissions from, let's say, things like agriculture and other things. And so it's that, you know, 5 to 10% that's almost impossible to remove is what should be offset, not the 100%, you know, like our Canada net zero plan says, which is, you know, we'll increase our oil sands and, you know, our oil and gas production and then offset it all. And so that's the first thing, you know. So when I'm talking about using natural climate solutions as a climate mitigation tool, I'm not trying to give companies and countries a way out of their, you know, the responsibility they have to reduce emissions first and then offset them. Yeah, they are cheaper in terms of, you know, how much are these carbon credits, the price they are trading at compared to, you know, let's say something like carbon capture and sequestration, which will cost billions and billions of dollars. And it is totally unproven at scale right now from the existing plants that we have. So when we talk about NCS being a cost-effective solution, it is actually a way cheaper compared to the same price that you would get to reduce, let's say, or pull out 1 ton of carbon dioxide equivalent from the air using other technological means. And they have an important role to play. You know, we've seen that, you know, we've seen the huge deforestation that's happening in the Amazon. A part of my project is really looking at that. There are a lot of different initiatives like Red Plus, which is reduced emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. And, you know, NCS is starting to get scaled up, but it's nowhere near the level we need it to be, which should be trading in billions of dollars. And yeah, so, you know, the link that you mentioned, I just posted the first, we're coming out with a briefing note series, which will be explaining, you know, what are some of these issues. And by issues, I mean, I began with saying how, you know, offsets have a bad, what do you say? Like people think of them not in the right light and they think of them as something like greenwashing. And so there are many other concerns in this space, which is the integrity of these credits. By integrity, I mean, is the 1 ton I'm paying for, am I really getting 1 ton reduction? And right now there are some issues within this space of natural climate solutions crediting that, you know, we could make better in terms of the integrity of the credits, in terms of equity, you know, demand side equity and supply side equity. You know, should, you know, we have this fear when we talk of just transitions that it's going to be another land grab and another way of colonization of, you know, indigenous lands, where now if you're not taking them over for oil and gas extraction, now you'll take them over for either renewables or for, you know, planting trees and, like, again, take away their, you know, it's just another form of colonization. So that those are equity issues. How are we doing it right? Are we working with the indigenous communities? How are they sharing benefits? What is their role in the system? Because they have been caretakers and stewards of the land. So there's a lot of these concerns and complexities, and our briefing note series and an eventual handbook, which I am writing for, hopefully, should be, the first draft should be ready end of the year. We'll be looking at some of these complexities. So given that these will play a very important role, because most companies and countries in all their net zero plans have put in NCS crediting as a way to reach their net zero goals. And was that a little more clear, or am I being too scientist-y?
You touched on one thing I wanted to follow up on a bit, which is, you mentioned how, it could lead to some sort of colonization by these corporations of indigenous lands. But just more broadly, do you have any concerns? Because that's the one I think I've come across the most, is that these sort of trading programs could lead to increased privatizations of what used to be commons. And do you have any concerns, and how would you address those?
Yeah, and that is, like I said, that really is like this whole equity issue with it. And it's conversations I've been having. So it's not just me doing this research. I'm actually collaborating with other partners, like, other ENGOs, working with governments, working with indigenous communities, and talking to them in, places like Brazil, where we've had Red Plus programs, speaking with, local communities as well. So really trying to understand how I'm working on this project is really having these conversations with experts and people involved in this space, including the communities whom it would impact, and asking them what are some of these issues they faced, how do they see this being resolved, and what would these future finance systems, contracts, and crediting systems look like where it would be equitable. And sorry about that, that's my puppy just destroying things in the background. Really working with them and seeing, discussing things like land rights or, benefit, like Avi said, if somebody is selling credits, is it somebody who, has had rights to the land, like indigenous communities, who should get the benefit? Is it some external company that comes in and says, I'm going to plant trees here? Should they get the benefit? We don't have all the answers, but we are trying to speak with the communities. We've just started this project. We've not really answered them yet. But these are the things we're hoping to clarify. These are the things we are hoping to clarify in the handbook and the briefing note series to really reach this answer. But some of the things I can say is there's something we call jurisdictional. A lot of these projects are done at the crediting is done at the project scale. But when you look at jurisdictional, that becomes at like a BC level or a Canada level offsetting. And I think some of these land rights and issues get a little easier to resolve at that scale. So yeah, there's no simple answer yet. And those are the things, complexities and issues we will be getting into in these briefing note series and the upcoming handbook. So stay tuned for some of this exciting stuff.
So there's another area that regarding, climate policy, and that's not often talked about, and it's cooling. According to the Cooling Emissions and Policy Synthesis Report from the United Nations Environment Program, like, more efficient cooling methods could prevent as much as 460 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions over the next 40 years. This is roughly equal to 8 years of greenhouse gas emissions at 2018 levels. How should the city be handling this issue of cooling, especially as we move into much, much warmer and drier summers?
Are you talking about like cooling using technology? Because there's different kinds of cooling. So I want to just clarify what type of cooling, like.
So, for example, with refrigerants and phasing out of refrigerants and using more sustainable cooling methods for refrigeration and cooling of homes.
Okay, yes. All right. So you were talking about that. Sorry. Being too much into this, I'm like, well, there's three kinds of cooling I could talk about. I think one of the easiest things we've been hearing a lot about, in fact, BC Hydro has been advertising about it, or maybe they're just targeting me because I care about these things on the online ads, is one of the best things we should be investing in is heat pumps, which they really have a bad name. We need to rename them into something else because, technically they pump heat. It depends in which direction you want them to pump, inside or outside. So in the winter, they pump heat in the summer, they'll pump heat out. So they cool and they heat your home. Right. And so what did we see when we had the heat dome, which happened last year, and we lost so many hundreds of people in this province? While we have heating in our homes in BC and in Vancouver, not a lot of people have air conditioning. We don't even have a fan. And, when it's hitting 40 degrees, it's almost unbearable. And so we need to look into this. And, you know, some of the other things you can do to help this is better insulation, retrofitting of the homes. But these things are expensive, and the homes and the people who need them most are usually the poorer people, the older homes that people don't have so much money to fix. And, you know, it's obviously the marginalized. And so definitely, I don't know personally at the city level how much money we have to be able to help, but we have the authority and we have the power to work with the province, to work with the federal government, to really apply for these grants and to help retrofit some of these most marginalized and poorest and oldest households. Because that's not only like, you know, helping them survive the summers, but it's also reducing emissions because a lot of emissions happen from badly insulated homes. You need to heat it more. You need to cool it more. And so, you know, just like in you know, when we had that electricity crisis in Texas, people were getting very cold, but they have better insulated homes. That wouldn't have been an issue and they wouldn't have needed as much heating. So it can work both ways. And it would really help, especially, I think, in BC, if we look at a lot of our indigenous communities, you know, we need to really do a good job in giving them, in retrofitting homes for them and working with them and working with the governments to get these grants to people. And a lot of these grants are usually targeted as homeowners. I would like to see some of these grants targeted at renters, because there are older rental buildings in this city where a person, a for-profit company managing those rental homes might not care as much. But if a renter could apply for it and it's not costing the company, then why shouldn't the renter be more comfortable and have access to lower heating and cooling bills and be able to survive another heat dome and hotter summers as we are going to experience with climate change?
Since you mentioned, you know, the other types of cooling, so perhaps could you touch upon what you think we can do at the municipal level to...
So, you know, one of the things is like we, you know, when we have these like, you look at LA and other places like that, they become heat islands. LA has its own like weather systems because of the amount of concrete. So luckily in Vancouver, we do have a lot of tree cover and we have like, you know, the ocean that comes in. But at the same time, you know, when we start building more houses and more buildings to, you know, accommodate and more people as they move into the city and to actually provide more truly affordable housing, we need to be very careful about A, that we are building very climate conscious and, you know, climate resilient buildings. But B, you know, what are we doing to reduce this heat island effect? And so I actually worked with two municipalities in the U.S. to help create just climate action plans for them to reach their, to get them to net zero by 2050. And we looked into things like, you know, when you're building roads, about making permeable pavements on the side, you know, having the trees in the middle. And the trees, reminds me, that's one thing in Vancouver we should do a lot better is manage our trees, our urban trees. They were suffering in the heat dome last time. You know, things like green roofs. Green roofs are very easy, and they really reduce the amount of reflection that happens from the sun. This would help in sequestering and also like just providing green spaces and to having I really would like to see community, not just community gardens, but like community food forests, right? Where people can actually go and be able to access, and those trees will not just provide shade, but also food for people who need like fresh food, for those who could, you know, who would really benefit from access to that. So there are quite a lot of things we could be doing and should be doing at the city level, but definitely looking at green roofs, you know, as one of the ways, you know, we do get a lot of our power from hydro, but there are places in the U.S., there are schools and all who have covered parking lots with solar panels, right? That's another way you can look at the reducing the reflecting. We don't have a lot of, luckily, thank God, open parking lots in Vancouver. But, you know, where we have these open spaces, we want to make sure that, you know, we are looking into it as in terms of reducing the reflecting of the sun's energy, but also looking at how it is going to benefit the ecosystem and the people around going.
Yeah, so switching topics a bit. So you mentioned earlier, you know, housing and is probably the most pressing issue for most people when they think about especially local elections in Vancouver. BC Housing Minister David Eby has proposed enforced minimum amounts of housing approvals based on population growth for municipalities. What is your perspective on this, and how should we be tackling this crisis?
Yeah, so housing, like you said, housing and affordability, they go hand in hand, and it's very important. As I mentioned earlier, somebody who's, you know, been at UBC and lived in the city of Vancouver, where I was in the first few years of my PhD paying almost 100% of my rent in my stipend in rent, like that is not affordable, right? If I'm paying everything I earn in rent, like what does that leave like for my other bills or food? You know, unless you've eaten cereal for breakfast, lunch, and dinner for a week, you don't know what affordability means. And so, you know, there's two, like, you'll see a lot of political parties saying, oh, let's build more houses, because basic economics says, well, increase supply, and if the demand's the same, then the prices should fall. But, you know, that's not all. Prices would fall, but they usually fall for the median income or above. But what about the poorest in our society, the people, the 50% that fall below the median? And so we can build more houses, but we need to make sure that we are looking at them building more houses that are truly affordable. And for me personally, affordability, and for the Greens, you know, the way the Greens define affordability is 30% of a person's income. And right now, the way affordability is defined in Vancouver and in other places is to look at, oh, below market housing, or, like, you know, you're looking at median income and what's affordable for that. But like I said, you're leaving half of society out, and it's not truly affordable. So we do need to increase our supply, but we need to make sure we are increasing our supply for affordability, redefining affordability, and really making it accessible for people. And, you know, when we are doing this and building more apartments, we shouldn't be tearing down the older buildings, right? So there's some older, like, just in my neighborhood where I live in Kitsilano, there's some older rental buildings which are actually, like, you know, I wouldn't say truly affordable for everyone, but more affordable than the newer buildings. But when you look at some of the initiatives, people want to break these older buildings down and rebuild them. But if you do that, what's the guarantee that the people living there right now with their rent locked in, and let's say $1,000 or $1,200 a month, will get that same rate in the new building that's built? So how about, you know, building new buildings and you know, instead, like, retrofitting and spending money in making, you know, making sure these buildings are climate resilient, but building new ones somewhere else? So that's what I mean is, you know, you can't just increase supply. You have to see where to increase supply. And are we truly increasing supply that's affordable? Or is it just bringing down the average rental price for median income and the rich? Because that's what happens when you build, more housing. It's not often more affordable housing that's being built. Rents fall for a lot of people who can, like I said, for the median income or above. And so we really need to look at this.
Switching topics a little bit, I worked in a recreational cannabis store, and during my time there, you know, a lot of people would come in who were using illicit drugs and, you know, were in rehabilitation programs and used marijuana as a way to alleviate some of the symptoms of withdrawal that they were experiencing. And one person shared their experience with overdose and how it affected them and people they knew. You know, over the course of a month, I met this person maybe 5 or 6 times, and nearly every time they would share an experience of overdose that affected them or someone they knew. I asked them how their city should be approaching this crisis, and the one thing they felt really strongly about was that you know, police arresting people for simple possession is the wrong way to go about this.
I totally agree.
What strategies do you seek to implement on city council to address this crisis?
Yeah, and you know, this is something I spoke about a lot during my provincial election too, was that we need to decriminalize drugs. And, you know, because once you decriminalize it, you can actually get them the people to help. These are not just, oh, some random people on the streets. These are our friends, family, neighbors, you know. And the reason this is happening is we've allowed them to fall through the cracks of society. And so it's, you know, instead of criminalizing them and what's happening with them, we need to be giving them the right help. And, you know, policing is not that. We need to decriminalize it. Now, as we saw, the city doesn't have much control over police or the police budget, because they actually didn't pass the $7 million dollar increase. And then the province just overturned that and is now forcing the city to fund the police by that much. So some of that has to come from the higher level, like the province, to decriminalize it, so that a lot of this police, then you don't have to get your police to enforce it. And, you know, when that's not happening, you probably don't need as much funding, you know, for certain programs within the police. So I really think, you know, one of the thing is, major thing is pushing the province, pushing the federal government. And I don't know how much a city can rule. Can a city ask for exception that we can decriminalize at our level? But if that's a possibility, then it should definitely be done. And we should be getting more social workers, more welfare workers to work with the people suffering from this, because, you know, they do need help. Like I said, they're our friends, families, and our neighbors. And we shouldn't be, you know, letting them fall through the cracks of society. That's on us.
So BC does have an application to to the federal government to allow us to decriminalize drugs. But we'll have to see what the federal government has to say about that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's very important. I really do hope that the federal government listens. But, you know, I thought that this, because it's going through a police department and the city funds it, we should have control over it. But apparently we don't. And so that would be another thing to look into, would be this reform of the police act at the province level, where the cities can have more say. And if the cities can have more say on the police department, then you can actually direct them what you want them to police and what you don't want them to police. And, you know, right now, if so, I do know that there is a ongoing committee in government, and Adam Olson, our BC Green MLA, is part of that, to looking at the reforming of the police act. But I think they also need to have someone from a municipality level represented there to tell them about the you know, issues that municipal jurisdictions face when it comes to having control over the people who are policing their streets and their citizens.
Let's pivot again onto our final question. Vancouver has an at-large voting system for city councillors. This means that the 10 councillors represent the whole of Vancouver. Charlie Smith, the editor of the Georgia Strait, has often argued that this system discriminates against minorities and those with non-European surnames. What are your thoughts on the system, and how are you navigating this as a candidate?
Frankly, I think the at-large system is a lot better than our first-past-the-post system that we have for the province and what we have for our, you know, federal government, because then, I feel first-past-the-post system is usually actually more discriminatory towards people. But I know there's a lot of people saying that we should have wards back in Vancouver, and I know there are certain parties that have been pushing for wards. What's my opinion on that? My opinion is, I think we need proportional representation no matter what system we have. Because when we have proportional representation, it makes it a lot easier, like you said, for minorities, for people with non-traditional last names, and for also truly the people getting the government they vote for. But beyond the electoral system, what we need to change is how the campaigning is done. I can tell you personally, as a person who ran federally and a person who ran provincially, you know, it was really hard because I have a full-time job. I'm not rich. I have to keep my full-time job and work to be able to pay my rent, which, like I said, was most of my income. You know, and now it's still a lot of my income. It's not anywhere close to affordable. I can't just drop everything. And this is me, and I still feel privileged enough to be able to run because I have an academic scientific job where a thing like, if I was to do a debate, which these debates happen during work hours, during the middle of the week, I can still attend an all candidates debate and then work later in the evening or on the weekend. If, you know, if we really want people from all walks of life to be in our government, for our government to really look like the citizens of this city and of, you know, the country, like, you know, at all levels, we need to do better. A minimum wage worker who has to, or a person who has to work 9 to 5 in an office, they cannot run an election campaign. So do I have answers on how to improve that? No, but I think we really need to improve these systems and support people who are renters, people who are minimum wage workers, people who are, you know, are people of color, indigenous people. We need to be able to create a system where it is a lot easier for them to even run and campaign. And definitely, 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 we need electoral reform. It's one of the green values is proportional representation. We've heard every government say, this is going to be the last first past the post election, and then we don't hear anything after that. So I really think, you know, we need to do that. But having councillors at large rather than first past the post, I feel is a little easier and more equitable because I don't have to be someone's top choice. I need to be one of their top choices, right? So even if I have a different last name and I am a person of color, but I think it also comes down to a lot of education and, you know, work around racism in our communities. And, you know, it's not a us versus them. We all live in this planet. We all live in this city and we all care about it. You know, there's a lot of things that need to be done. And we are nowhere close to it being easy for a non-traditional sounding name or a looking person to run in politics at any level of government right now.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that. So what, from your perspective, like, what would you attribute, like, you can see at the MLA level, at the federal level, there are a lot more, you know, visible minorities, but at the city council level, it's basically all white. What would you attribute that to? Is it just like a funding issue, or like, what's your perspective on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of it could have to do with funding. We also, you know, now we have a lot of local parties, but I know, like, being an immigrant, like, until a few years ago, you know, I was just trying to get along, earn money, pay my bills in this country, and wasn't really involved in what was happening. And I've seen a lot of other people, you know, who don't get that involved in politics, because when you first immigrate here, you're just trying to care for yourself and your family and provide for them. So I don't know. You're right. We do see a lot more at the federal and, you know, provincial level across the country. And I don't have an answer for that, frankly. I don't know. I do know funding is a big issue in all the elections I've run. But, you know, and like I said, for me, it's more about finding the time and energy to be able to run with a full-time job. And I think a lot of immigrants, like I said, come here, they're starting from scratch and they're really busy building those lives. But like you said, but maybe it should be the same at a federal and a provincial level. Why at the city level? Frankly, I don't know. It's not something I've been able to figure out.
Thanks for your time today, Dr. Singh. Is there anything else about the Vancouver Greens you would like to highlight before we drop?
Yeah, I can always say, like, you know, I run Green because they're the people who most closely represent my values. And I know a lot of people think adversely about the Greens for certain issues. From what I have seen, they've thought through each of the motions and how they vote on it very thoroughly. Like I said, you know, I've seen a lot of back on certain councillors that, oh, they didn't vote for every housing plan. And like I said, not all housing that's being built means it's affordable. And so, you know, if, you know, you truly need to look at the motion and what it means. You just can't build more houses and, you know, build more for-profit houses. They need to be affordable for everyone. We need to redefine affordability. There's a lot of misinformation, we all know, out there on social media. So I would suggest people do their own research. And, you know, I have seen the green councillors, the Green Parks Board, commissioners, and I've seen the even the ones in the school board, they've done a lot for the city. And that's kind of why I decided to run with the Greens, was I've really seen the impact they've had on the city. They've done good work. They're very committed. In fact, in my meetings with Mike, Pete, and Adrian and over the past few weeks, ever since I became a candidate, I have just been amazed at the dedication and the sheer love and compassion they have for the people of the city and how truly committed they are in the work they do. So I really hope when people get out to vote, you know, in October, you go through people's platforms, you look at the work they've done, and in the end, you know, like choose the top 10 people who you truly think will work for you. You know, forget about what party. I would, you know, don't think this person's a Green or this person's a One City or this person's a COPE. Look at the person. I always said that in the provincial and federal election too. I said, vote for the person because that's your representative. Once elected, a person should be your spokesperson. They are no longer part of a party, right? And especially with the Greens, our votes are not whipped at any level of government. That means I'm free to vote on my conscience and what my people and the people I represent truly want. And so, you know, listen to everybody out there. Listen to what they're saying. Look at how genuine they are and vote for the individual. Forget party politics. Where has that gotten us at any level of government? You know, I wish truly we could be a nonpartisan world where everybody could run as an independent. But again, like you said, where would funding come from? But if we could do that, I think, you know, you're voting for the person. Vote for people who work with others well, because there's going to be 10 city councillors. You want to vote for a person who cares about you, will represent you well, and who's actually shown that they can work across party lines, across with other councillors to get things really done for you and the city, and they care about you. So that's what I would say.
This episode was edited by myself, Akhil Krishman, and my co-host, Irman Reina. The music in this piece is by Sarah Pratt. You can find her on SoundCloud at the handle Leisure Noise. The link is in the description. Please subscribe to our podcast for future episodes, and thank you for listening.